Welcome, everyone. We are still in chapter 1, Male and Female, He Made Them. You have a reading from St. Augustine from City of God. When I first came into the church as a teenager, of course I needed formation. I'm sorry to say that I went to a parish, I went to the parish on the Wednesday for the young people formation. These are kids who are preparing for confirmation. The kids were just so cynical and so disengaged. And very often you have people, their hearts are in the right place, they want to volunteer for these things, but they're not all that well formed themselves. I didn't go back. And I think it was one of the things that helped in terms of being able to stay on the course for coming into the church. My godfather, or the man who became my godfather, very generously would meet with me, and he was doing this for his own son at the same time. Basically, my formation was these tapes of Archbishop Fulton Sheen, and it's where You Shall Know the Truth. And so, and cassettes, I'm dating myself here, these cassette tapes where it gave you an overview of the creed, the sacraments, the Ten Commandments, and the prayer and the prayer and the last things. And then after I came into the church, we continued with that. And that's very important. Very often we think about the RCIA process, we think about getting people in, but they need a year after that of ongoing support and formation. Generally speaking, unless you're in unusual circumstances, that first year is not easy. That first year of trying to live as a Catholic. So I kept going over his house on Sunday nights, and we finished the Fulton Sheen. So the next thing that he picked up, I don't know why he lighted on this, but he got the abridged version of St. Augustine's City of God. And so we read that. And especially once you, the first half of City of God is very much an apologetic, engaged with the pagan critics of Christianity. And there are things of value there. But it's the second half, starting in around book 11, where he starts to give you this overview of what he calls the history of the city of God and the history of the city of man. He gives you this overview of salvation history. And I want to say the first, I think it's 11 to about 14, he talks about the creation of the angels, the creation of man, the fall of the angels, the fall of man, what man was like in the garden before sin, what the impact of sin was. It was this very intensive study and explanation of really the beginnings of salvation history. And that was something that sustained me for the whole of my Catholic life, young life going off to college. So often our young people do not have some kind of firm foundation in just those first three chapters of Genesis, which you've got to have. When I would talk to students at Boston College and I would bring up things from that opening of Genesis, I would get this kind of, aw, come on, you really believe in a man, a woman, a snake, and a tree? And these are kids who have been in Catholic schools, right, the whole of their young life. But what also became clear is there are all these foundational things to your Christian belief, which at the point where that all just becomes metaphor, figurative language, mythology, that undermines centrally who Jesus said he was, who he is, what he came to do. So what I shared with you in this reading is from City of God and from this section where he's talking about Adam and Eve in the garden and what their life was like in terms of their romantic and conjugal desire for each other. And there are many reasons to give it to you. I think Augustine does a beautiful job of this. It's a really lovely text. But part of the reason that I share this with you is I think that there's that Augustine gets a lot of bad press for being anti-woman, anti-sex, anti-marriage. And so part of what I share with you is to help in a way, defend Augustine against this perception that this is somebody who really understands the naturalness of marital love, and wants us to try to see the beauty of what marital love would be like, uncontaminated from sin. And that and as he says in our reading, this is almost impossible for us to do, because our whole lived experience is the fallenness of our sexual desire and fallenness of our sexual love. One of the things that C.S. Lewis says in Miracles is the very presence of obscene humor or sexual humor. Part of what that points to, that can be funny, it can be offensive, it can be both. But one of the things that you see in humor is that there is something fallen about our sexual desire, right? All of that humor presupposes something out of order, out of whack, not the way that it should be. So, point number one here: Saint Augustine, antibody, anti-marriage. From where does this come? A lot of people who I think their exposure to Saint Augustine is from reading the Confessions in college. Maybe they went to a Catholic college, Lutheran college, or even just a more advanced program where that's going to be on the reading list. And it's true that Saint Augustine, reflecting on his lived experience, he admits that sexual desire, that lust, was something that kept him from living a godly life. It was one of the things that kept him away from the church. And a big part of his coming back was receiving the gift of continence, being able to receive the gift of sexual self-control. And in fact, this is usually one of the parts of the Confessions that people remember. They remember the opening: "You have made us; our hearts are restless with, until they rest in Thee." Everybody remembers that. And people usually either remember the "Give me chastity, but not just yet." People remember that too, and that's from that same that's from the same from this later section of the Confessions, right as he's coming in. The additional thing that would provide ammunition for this, I think, misreading of Augustine, are treatises such as the Marriage and Concupiscence. Marriage and Concupiscence is part of a group of treatises that are called Anti-Pelagian Tracts. And to understand that, you have to recall who Pelagius is. The Pelagian heresy was this heresy in the early church, taught by this, I believe he's English, this English religious, who said that man is not wounded by original sin. That we behave badly is because of bad socialization or bad example, but it's not like we have an inborn tendency to sin. Pelagius denied that. In the modern world, we usually don't have the word Pelagian or Pelagius to associate with it, but where you run into this idea of man being unfallen, that this kind of original goodness, in the modern world, that goes back to Jean-Jacques Rousseau. So the political and social thinker who's really, the intellectual architect of the French Revolution. If you read The Discourse on the Origin of Inequality, or even better, Emile, you get this picture of human beings who they're undamaged. If they're bad, again, it's bad socialization, bad schools, bad institutions. You reform the institutions, you reform humanity. That's the idea. Unfortunately, the Emile is enormously influential in education circles. So you can be dealing with otherwise quite sensible educators who, when it comes to children and the inner tendency to badness, this is something that educators, many, they can't see, even though their experience goes against them. And because they've been formed in this thinking that really goes back to Rousseau, this idea of man's unfallen nature, and somehow you just give them the right socialization, the right techniques, the right methods, they'll just behave wonderfully. There's no inner tendency to badness. Well, needless to say, if you are St. Augustine and you are responding to this belief that somehow we are not fallen, you are going to be emphasizing the ways in which human nature is wounded. So a Pelagian is going to look at marriage and not see those sacramental graces of marriage as really being necessary. Okay? When we talk about the sacrament of marriage, the specific grace of marriage, according to St. Thomas, is that you are able to love your spouse as a Christian should. You are able to will the good for them. If you think about the book of Tobit, remember that Sarah marries these seven guys, and this demon Asmodeus comes along and kills every one of them. And once Tobias comes into town and he wants to marry her, Dad is getting ready to dig another grave in the backyard. But he has the great benefit of the angel Raphael. And the angel Raphael tells him, you are going to spend 3 days in prayer with your wife, and I will bind the devil. And that's what he does. This devil is bound. And Tobias makes this lovely speech to his bride, where he says, we are not like the Gentiles who know not God, who couple together like the animals. But we love each other in the Lord. In other words, St. Thomas will take that passage. That is the grace of marriage, that the devil would be bound from contaminating your marriage with low desire, and that instead you would be able to love each other as persons, not just as animals or as objects, not just out of lust or passion, but to love each other, to will each other's good. Okay, that's the specific grace of marriage. So Augustine is going to emphasize the way in which grace needs to be active in our marriage. So yes, marriage and concupiscence, you are going to be emphasizing how naturally that desire is disordered and what remedies that it needs. However, that's not Augustine's last word. Part of the reason that Augustine is in the position where he has to address this is earlier, as a recovering Manichaean. Remember, the Manichaeans are this group that really did believe that the body was bad, matter was bad, physical desire was bad, the sexual union was bad, having children was bad, right? It's this family of erroneous religions, heretical religions in the early church, that all deny the goodness of matter, that matter is this kind of evil principle out there. Spirit is good, matter and the body are bad. Augustine was in this for a number of years, but broke out of it and came into the church. And one of the early things that he starts doing is responding to that Manichaeism of which he was a part. So he's the one who writes this treatise, The Good of Marriage. And any kind of marriage preparatory program that's worth its salt is going to introduce you into these three marriage goods: fertility, fidelity, sacrament. Right? Fertility, that naturally marriage is about bringing children into the world and, right, nurturing them, educating them, bringing them to adulthood. Fidelity, that this is a union that is meant to be exclusive. Right? You belong to your spouse. The wife is the woman of the man. The man is the husband of the woman. This is meant to be exclusive. And then three, sacrament, that they confer on each other the means of conferring grace upon each other, because this union is meant to signify the union of Christ and the church. Just as Christ and the church are meant to have an unbreakable union, so the union between man and woman is meant to be unbreakable. I have had students ask me, does that mean into the afterlife? No, when you say your vows, you say, till death do you part. We are not Mormons. We don't think we're getting a planet in the afterlife and we're populating the planet. No. Till death do you part. That ends the marriage. So in other words, if you are getting Augustine's teaching on marriage, you need both of these things. You need both treatises. You need both perspectives. When he's responding to the Manichaeans, he's emphasizing what is good about marriage. and he is deliberately de-emphasizing what's wounded or bad about it. Because these are people who think that marriage, sexuality, childbearing, yuck! They think all those things are bad. So he's emphasizing what's good. Conversely, when he is responding to Pelagians who think that we don't need any kind of remedy for our woundedness within marriage, he is emphasizing what is a problem, what is, right? What needs remedy? What needs our assistance? If you just had this, you might think, I don't know, that guy ever really got out of Manichaeism. If he just got that, you might think, this guy just overcorrected. There's no such thing as a teaching or an explanation, in other words, apart from context, that you can't say everything that needs to be said all the time to all people. There are things where you need to tailor what you're saying given the audience that you're talking to. So in other words, what I'm saying here is that Augustine does have a balanced view, but it's a balanced view that comes from that you'll see if you read the whole thing, and not just anti-Pelagian tracts or his own personal struggles when you read the Confessions. And that's the thing that I think comes out wonderfully in what it is that you read. On the one hand, he admits to the woundedness that's within human sexuality. That's why we have such a hard time understanding what this would have looked like for Adam and Eve before they fell. But on the other hand, he's somebody who knows that there such a thing was possible. Such a thing was there, that our sexuality is not intrinsically damaged by what it is. That Adam and Eve have had something better, which they lost. In fact, if we're going to talk about people in the early church who really do seem to talk as if human sexuality is damaged just by what it is, that's going to be our Eastern fathers. Up to this point, I've been talking about Gregory of Nyssa, St. Gregory of Nyssa, St. John Chrysostom, St. John Damascene, as you know, wonderful commentators and as great fathers, and they are. But there's this one area where I would say there's almost a kind of blindness or a kind of confusion, and I actually wouldn't dare to disagree with Gregory of Nyssa or John Chrysostom or John Damascene if I didn't have St. Thomas and St. Augustine pointing it out to me. I'd be very reluctant to disagree with church fathers of this magnitude. So let's start with Gregory of Nyssa. Gregory of Nyssa, in the same thing that you've been reading on the making of man, this is what he says about marital love. And notice this text will keep coming back. Matthew 22:25. Here's St. Gregory of Nyssa from chapter 17 on the making of man. When the Sadducees once argued against the doctrine of the resurrection and brought forward to establish their own opinion that women of many marriages who had been wife to seven brethren and thereupon inquired whose wife she will be after the resurrection, our Lord answered their argument so as not only to instruct the Sadducees, but also to reveal to all that come after them the mystery of the resurrection life. For in the resurrection, he says, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, neither they die anymore, for they are equal to the angels. They are the children of God, being the children of the resurrection. Okay? That's Matthew 22:25. Now, listen to what St. Gregory of Nyssa does with this. Now, the resurrection promises us nothing else than the restoration of the fallen to their ancient state. For the grace we look forward to is a certain return to the first life, bringing back again to paradise him who was cast out of it. If then the life of those restored is closely related to that of the angels, it is clear that the life before the transgression was a kind of angelic life, and hence also our return to the ancient condition of life is compared to the angels. In other words, St. Gregory of Nyssa makes the inference that since we are being, as it were, brought into paradise, and we are told that we are going to be living like the angels, that is describing what our condition before the fall was. So before the fall, We should have been living this spiritual life in paradise in which there would have been no sexual union. How are we living like the angels if that's how they were living? Now, this is something that I think is an easy thing to confuse. When we look at that word paradise, what you can do is think that what was in the garden is essentially the same as what happens after you die and you're united with God. Please remember that not just on the physical side, even on the spiritual side, Adam and Eve did not enjoy the beatific vision. When I say that, I mean Adam and Eve did not have a direct supernatural vision of God, and that's the phrase we use when we're describing heaven. Okay, they had an intimacy with God that, of course, is far greater than what we have now. We talk about how God walked in the garden with them, right? There's this intimacy they have with God. But it's not an intimacy that is this direct vision. It's an elevated, it is still a state of supernatural grace. But when we talk about heaven, we're talking about glory. We're talking about this overflowing of a vision that is raising you above a natural condition. Adam and Eve had a supernatural condition in the sense that they had, right, grace, but they didn't have the superabundance of grace that we associate with the beatific vision. But for Gregory of Nyssa, he thinks we are getting, after the resurrection, a condition that really we had before. So if it's a life of the angels, it is a non-sexual life. Here is St. John Chrysostom. And again, this is something I've cited before. This is from the Homilies on Genesis, chapter 18. Now, Adam knew his wife. This is at the beginning of Genesis chapter 4, verse 1. Notice the precise date of this fact. It was only after their disobedience and their exile that Adam and Eve traded together. Before, they lived like angels, and they did not know the pleasures of the flesh. Ah, how could they have known them, since they were not subject to the needs of the body? Thus, in the order of time, virginity possesses the palm of the priority. But when the weakness of man had introduced disobedience and sin, she withdrew, because the earth was no longer worthy to possess, and then the law of concupiscence is established. Understand then, my dear brother, what is the dignity of virginity? It is a well-ascended and sublime virtue, and its possession is too much above human power, that we acquire it without a special succor, special help from divine power. And then, as he keeps, as he continues to write, and indeed, Jesus Christ himself declares to us that virgins are an immortal body, the emulators of the angels. The Sadducees questioned him one day on the resurrection and said, right, goes right back to this line from Matthew 22:25, right? If we are rising to the condition of angels, that is what we had in our earlier state. Go ahead, Cesarian.
I just have a question. When God walking with Adam and Eve in the garden, would that be similar to Jesus walking on the earth with his apostles?
No, because when Jesus walks on the earth, he has a physical body that's physically walking. So to talk about God walking in the garden means that there's a presence, that he is present to them, that he is near to them, but not that he has, right, feet and legs. In fact, that's also signified by after the fall. Remember when God asks, "Where are you?" The point of that question is, you're not with me. Wherever you are, you're not with me. So there's intimacy there. There's closeness. But it's not a closeness of God is standing there, I'm standing here. It is a closeness of where is Adam and Eve? Where are their hearts? Where are their minds? Go ahead, Ms. Bettina.
How would these writers have reconciled God saying, be fruitful and multiply, if they had no sex before the fall?
I am getting there.
Okay.
That is St. John Damascene. So let me answer that. Here's John Damascene, The Exposition of the Orthodox Faith, Book 2, Chapter 30. Okay? And St. John Damascene comes later than all these folks. He's a 7th century writer. Or sorry, 8th century, 700s, I believe. And St. John Damascene, or John of Damascus, sometimes you'll see it like that, he is very often called the Thomas Aquinas of the East. So the way that St. Thomas in the Latin-speaking or Western world takes all of these fathers and writers and synthesizes them into one work, that's what John of Damascus is. He takes a lot of the Eastern writers, not just Gregory, John Chrysostom, and Basil, but Athanasius, Gregory Thaumaturgus, all of these other Eastern writers. And in the Exposition of the Orthodox Faith, it's as best as one, you know, this isn't an exact fit, but it's almost like the Eastern Orthodox Summa. If you were to have something like the Summa Theologia of St. Thomas in the East, it's the Exposition of the Orthodox Faith by St. John of Damascus. So here's what he says. Right to, in fact, to Mrs. Bettina's text. They will perhaps ask, what then is the meaning of male, female, be fruitful and multiply? In answer, we shall say that be fruitful and multiply does not altogether refer to multiplying by the marriage connection. For God had power to multiply the race also in different ways, if they kept the precept unbroken to the end. But God, who knoweth all things before they have existence, knowing in his foreknowledge that they would fall into transgression in the future and be condemned to death, anticipated this and made them male and female and bade them to be fruitful and multiply. Let us then proceed on our way and see the glories of virginity, for this also includes chastity. In other words, God would have multiplied human beings like he multiplies the angels. We don't need the intervention of man and woman. But God, foreknowing that man would fall, made them male and female and talks about human beings coming from this union because we were that was the natural then way of doing it. But had we stayed in this original state, that union would not have been necessary. Okay? So again, before I respond to this over there with St. Thomas, I want to make the point that St. Augustine is the one who gets criticized for thinking that somehow human sexuality is bad, that it's irredeemably bad. He has this kind of excessive admiration for the consecrated state, for consecrated virginity or religious life. They're just, marriage is always like this kind of come down in his theology or in his thinking. And the case I'm making to you is that Augustine is all about showing how marriage is naturally good as part of his bigger project of saying that all things that God made are good. It's not that he's riveted on that in particular. It's that God creates things and declares them good. And that's him breaking away from this Manichaean heresy that just saw the evils of the world as something that's part of our material condition. This is something that I will dedicate the whole next talk to, that we'll talk about next week. Or I should say the week after, because we have next week off for Thanksgiving. That when God declares things and declares them good, you're not saying that those things are good, they have no flaws, they have nothing wrong with them. Like, all he's doing is creating perfect things. No, they have a goodness to them, which means they may be flawed or vulnerable in certain ways, but they are still good. In other words, God wills things to exist even when they aren't perfect things. You know, rhododendrons and rocks and oak trees and aardvarks. It's not like all those things are somehow perfect, but God still wills their existence with all the flaws that go along with being an aardvark or a rhododendron. Okay? So it is, in fact, in these Eastern fathers that virginity and religious virginity is all. And it looks like sexuality is something that's part of the package of our fallen condition. Because they really picture a condition before the fall as if we are just living like angels. And that wouldn't be, as it were, lowered or polluted by having sexual activity. Okay? They picture an angelic state being man's original state. That would be the simple way of putting it. And they don't see that what we have in the afterlife is this elevated supernatural state that we have traveled through, as it were, a natural state to get to. Okay? It's not that we don't end up in a way like what the Eastern Fathers are describing, but what the Eastern Fathers are describing is a goal. That's not where we started. Where we started is lower than, in fact, that goal. We start in a state of nature and grace. We don't start in a state of glory. And it is through that path of nature and grace that we get now this supernaturalized life. When we talk about after the resurrection, that you have a glorified body, that you arise in youth and vigor and beauty, that you are free from all disease, you are free from all age, you're free from all the needs of the body, that is a supernaturalized state. And you will live in a supernaturalized world. Right? It will be a world that isn't like the world that you live in the present. Because all the things that are corrupt or corruptible about it will vanish. Okay? Yeah, go ahead.
So I'm going through First Communion with one of my children, and in the Bible it says that Adam and Eve, when God said, "Where are you?" and you know, they just started like blaming each other. They asked for forgiveness. So had they asked for forgiveness, would it be different?
It would be better if they had done that. Okay. But the damage was done. Okay. It's like I remember when my kids put a big old dent in the neighbor's garage door, you know, because it's those metal doors. By the way, I found somebody in I think it was Rockford. You do this with cars. You can put this little suction thing, right? It pulls the dents right out. Oh my gosh, I almost cried because I was so happy. If it had been my door, I could have put up with it denting the neighbor's door. Anyway, but as I tell my kids, you know, you can be sad and you can look real sorry and you can mean it, but there's still a dent in the neighbor's door. And likewise, Adam and Eve, it would have been better if they had owned up, but were they still going to get exiled? Yeah, because their condition was now changed. Their condition wasn't the same. When we think of a fallen condition, it's like we think of it as something external, like I dropped something or broke something, and then you just think, well, we just get a new one, right? And it isn't like that. It's an inner state. This is the very thing that it's very difficult to explain to, let's say, my 10th graders. We'll have a unit where we talk about, can one do evil that good may come of it? And of course, it's always something like lying so that you can save life. But I will bring in adultery, or I'll bring in things like that. Okay, can you prostitute someone, as it were, to save life? And the thing that when you're younger that you don't get, that when you choose bad things and bad actions, it changes you. So it's not like you do this bad thing, you save life, or you save your house, or you save your job, or whatnot, and somehow on the inside you are not changed. The thing that I use as an example every year is, because I had a student ask me, we were talking about the Shakespeare play Measure for Measure, and the judge wants to sleep with this guy's sister, basically to let him go. You sleep with me and I'll let your brother go. And I had students ask me, students are actually this direct, well, if you were in the power of the dictator and he was in love with your wife, wouldn't you want your wife to sleep with the dictator to save your life? Wouldn't you want that? And I said, you know what? I will go home and ask my wife if Mrs. Hitler is going to be the one who actually, you know, is involved in this. I will go ask her. So I went home and I asked my wife. I said, "Here I am. I'm in the power of the dictator, and he's in love with you. Would you sleep with the dictator to save my life?" And my wife said, I might. But then I would resent you for the rest of our marriage because you would have been the source of my defilement. Okay? And I tell students, yes, Mrs. Hippler uses words like defilement. And, of course, they're 16. They don't know what defilement means. Some of them pick up, well, is it? It's like you're dirty or you're ruined. Or I said, exactly. But notice she's not talking about some kind of physical damage. She's not talking about something physical. She's talking about something on the inside. Think about the way that you might make a decision that you say, no, I can't do this. I have to live with myself. I have to live with myself. And again, when you're 15 or 16, that's kind of fuzzy to you. But you have to understand there's outside damage, there's inside damage. The outside damage is very clear to you. You see it. And you understand that when you choose things that damage you on the inside, you are not the same person on the other side of that. So you've, as it were, saved life, or you've saved this, or you've saved that. But what happened to you? It isn't the same. And that's how you have to think about Adam and Eve. That when they make that, it's not just something got taken away, like a car got taken, or the house, like a tree landed on the house. Something happened on the inside that now there has to be this transformation to get them back to where they were. Let's finish with St. Thomas over here in just the brief time that we have. St. Thomas, notice those two words I have up there, motive generation, animal life. He will say, basically the argument is, if God has given you these parts to bring, if he's given you these organs that are about having children, then this is what's natural. This is what God meant for you to do. They aren't just there sort of add-ons, extras, options, right? This is part of the human package. We were meant to reproduce in this way. And the confusion that's going on with our Eastern fathers here is they really cannot separate sexual desire, sexual activity from concupiscence. They're thinking of the very mode, they're thinking of the very form of generation as if there were something fallen about it all by itself. And St. Thomas, therefore, is siding with St. Augustine. We were meant to reproduce in this way. This is the animal part of our nature. This is part of who we are. This is how we're meant to reproduce. But what we have a hard time understanding is this can be done without the taint of sin. But unfortunately, Adam and Eve fell so early. Now this is out of our experience. But is it somehow part of the package of sexuality itself? No. Is it fitting that human beings reproduce in this way and don't just reproduce by, I don't know, some pure miracle of new children appearing in your house the next morning? Almost like, you know, babies left on the doorstep. Oh, we wanted one. We've been praying for a baby. And there it is. Right there it is in the basket. Every time you pray for a kid, boom. No, it is fitting that humans come together in a certain way, that you bear it within your womb, that you bring it out. But it is sin. That I know some of you are thinking, well, that doesn't sound so bad, actually, now that you mention it. But anyway, we will talk some of these things. We'll talk about more death, but next time.